In a piece published earlier this month headlined "American Meritocracy is Killing Youth Sports," The Atlantic's Derek Thompson reported that the share of children ages 6 to 12 who play a team sport on a regular basis declined from 41.5% in 2011 to 37% in 2017. Digging into those numbers, Thompson found that 69% of kids from households that have a greater than $100,000 annual income played youth sports, while that number was just 34% for children whose families earned less than $25,000. Thompson writes that declining athletic participation is a prime example of how the choices even benevolent rich households make can hurt poorer families, especially their children. Joining us now to discuss is Derek Thompson. He writes for The Atlantic. He's the host of the podcast Crazy Genius and the author of the book Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Welcome to the show, Derek.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
So can you explain that quote that I just read about declining athletic participation being an example of how the choices that rich households make and how they can hurt poorer families? How does that manifest itself in youth sports?
Yeah, so I think you set it up really well. What appears to be a sort of monotonic story of declining youth participation turns out to be more like a two-track story, where you have slightly rising participation among the rich and quickly declining participation among the poor. And I think that those sort of two directions are related, because one thing that happens is Tom Ferry, who's the executive director of Aspen Sports and Society Program, described to me, is that you have the rise of the club team or the travel sports team. So what will happen is a parent will say, I want little Johnny or little Sally to be really, really great at soccer, to get on her varsity team, maybe even get a college scholarship. I'm going to pay several thousand dollars to get her on a travel team. And that is going to put her with some of the best coaches, some of the other best players. She's going to really maybe have a good time on this travel team, build a lot of skills. But what happens at the local level is that as all these parents are essentially taking their children, their resources, and their own time and potential coaching time as well away from the local level, it's leaving these local towns' recreation leagues sort of desiccated.
But the numbers point to rising participation among wealthier families and in towns and cities where you have this sort of bifurcated youth sports system where the elite players or even just better than average players get siphoned off into quote unquote travel teams. Because look, these travel leagues can expand also, and they do expand. So What they want is more participation, so you can add teams or add divisions, and your, you know, Johnny or Susie can be participating.
Sally
can be participating.
Thank
you for correcting me, Josh. Johnny or Sally can be considered to be an elite player. But in these wealthier communities, you know, if participation is still rising, it doesn't seem to be affecting. The problem to me seems to be the lack of outreach and investment in lower income communities.
Oh, yeah. I definitely don't see that as an either or possibility. I mean, you can absolutely have a kind of opportunity hoarding phenomenon happening among richer families that are spending more and more and more on what used to be really low cost youth sports, while at the same time, because of other manifestations of opportunity hoarding, sort of income concentration and the rising privatization of a lot of previously public services, you also maybe have less investment in an array of things that are related to youth sports, like, say, you know, parks and rec budgets around the country. So, yeah, all these stories can be, you know, happening at the same time. And that's one of the reasons why I think that this story of declining youth sports, which initially just seems like it's either silly or it's just something caused by video games kind of story, turns out to be sort of a really fascinating metaphor for the unexpected ways that income inequality in the United States can manifest itself.
There's an analogy to public school here, right? And the notion that it's perhaps immoral, or if you don't want to frame it that harshly, that there are costs that if an individual, person, if you know, if somebody from a wealthy family decides, oh, I'm going to put my kid in a private school, once you have like an agglomeration of all of these people making all these choices, then the knock-on effects there in terms of public schooling can be really harsh and really severe, even if in an individual level, maybe the choice that somebody is making makes sense. And that it's, we need to think about these things societally in a systemic way. And in terms of youth sports, I think you're right, Derek, and that maybe because it doesn't seem like it's that important or it's like that big of a deal, this has sort of happened. And now we're looking at this system that seems broken. And we're like, well, you know, how can we fix it at this point?
Well, except that we often focus on the inequality of youth sports when we talk about how good we are as a country at particular sports. You know, the running conversation in soccer for the last two decades or more has been that we don't do a good enough job of recruiting and starting leagues in inner cities. We don't reach lower income children at a very young age to give them the initial opportunity that wealthier kids have from the jump.
I got more emails and letters to The Atlantic, to their main account, on this article than just about anything I've written, I'd say, in the last 5 years. I mean, it really, really struck a chord. I do not have children, and so I could only sort of report this third hand, I suppose. But the overwhelming response was, you just described what's happening in my community. Mm-hmm. And the effects are even worse when you look at this phenomenon in public schools. And I think it goes to this really, really big question of, you know, what is the cost of rich people loving their children a lot? I mean, you know, American households right now, if you sort of divide them into five quintiles, the richest quintile right now spends seven times as much on each child per household than the poorest quintile. That's larger than the child investment inequality in this country is larger than income inequality. It's even vaster for how much we spend on our children. And it's because, you know, rich people, you know, tend not to have that many children, tend to invest in them a lot, mm-hmm. and don't necessarily think about all the ways in which their investments are relatively zero sum. You know, when you pull a sort of a connection from your network to get your kid into an internship, well, that's probably a slot that's not going to go to somebody else. If you use, you know, if you sort of claim legacy status at some university, well, that's a seat that's going to your child that's not going to go to some other child.
I do have a child, and I have been involved in our local soccer rec league in D.C. for the last dozen years. And my observation sort of mirrors this. Like, what is my obligation as a wealthier parent? And I have viewed it as that this league, which serves predominantly higher income families in predominantly white neighborhoods of Washington, hasn't done an adequate job of supporting opportunities for kids from disadvantaged families. And yes, they scholarship a ton of kids. There are teams from the other side of the park in DC that participate in our rec leagues that are scholarshiped in. But, you know, should there be some surtax on my admissions, on my registration fee? Should we be paying another $20 or $50 per family to start full leagues that would give kids opportunities? That's what I've lobbied for with our local league. It hasn't happened yet, and the league does a good job of supporting other neighborhoods, but it's not enough because it is like the public-private school phenomenon. And in a lot of neighborhoods, the elite public schools sort of operate like de facto private schools. They have more sports opportunities. They have better fields. They have kids that have the ability to stay after school and travel and get to practice and go to games.
Derek, one thing that you don't really get into in the piece that occurred to me is the difference between sports, particularly basketball, is one that I was thinking about, because in soccer, the way that it's developed in this country historically is that it was a sport, I think, for like white suburban kids. Am I like botching this history, Stefan?
Not
like,
entirely. I mean, look, it evolved as an immigrant working class factory sport.
And in the last four decades,
yeah.
Whereas basketball obviously has a different history again in the last three or four decades. And there is this like really robust system around AAU teams of, you know, predominantly black poorer kids who are kind of subsidized by shoe companies. I mean, I'm talking about like really elite teams here, but we're sort of talking about a similar phenomenon in soccer with travel teams and whatnot. But we don't think of those like AU teams or shoe company sponsored teams as being, I don't know what the word is. It's like, they're kind of exploitative, right? And in a lot of ways. And so just access isn't the total like end all be all here. There needs to be systems here that ensure that even if there is, you know, increased access or ability for people of all economic backgrounds to participate in these sports, that these, you know, that there are systems in place that ensure that these kids are like not being taken advantage of. Like that, it seems like a really difficult thing to thread here.
This clicks into a lot of issues at the collegiate level, which I only skimmed the surface of in this piece. I mean, one big one that you didn't mention, but is, you know, surely at the tip of all of our tongues, is like, because a lot of these really, really talented, let's say often, you know, lower income, often Black, you know, men and women are playing basketball and football at the collegiate level, and they're often just compensated with a scholarship. More broadly, you know, the sheer amount of money that we spend on scholarships to student athletes has blown up in the last two decades. In the 1990s, I reported, Division I and Division II colleges distributed about $250 million a year in full and partial scholarships to student athletes. Now it's $3 billion. Some of that money is absolutely going to children from lower income families, but it also sends a really, really strong signal to a lot of upper middle class, upper class families, that there's enormous money in sports, which means that as soon as a lot of kids are entering, you know, first grade, kindergarten, their parents are already thinking, how do I find the sport that's perfect for them, hyper specialize them in that sport, and then set them up for the perfect resume builder or even scholarship. So there are so many different factors that are clicking in here, not just the sheer income inequality at the household level, but also this enormous carrot dangling for thousands and thousands of students in $3 billion worth of scholarships at D1 and D2 colleges.
You're pointing out this sort of this dichotomy between what rich families are doing and how the erosion of opportunity for lower income families is manifesting. And I guess what's not clear to me is the why. Why is participation declining in baseball, basketball, football, soccer, et cetera, for lower income kids? What's driving a decline? It can't just be that rich kids are leaving, because these leagues and these towns are frequently very bifurcated anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think several things could be going on. First, there was this article in the New York Times on the decline of youth soccer participation. And Chris Moore, the executive officer of U.S. Youth Soccer Association, told the Times, quote, "If you can't make a travel team, some kids say, what's the point, and quit playing altogether." So these kids are essentially among these peers, some of whom are rich, and they're saying, well, you know, the ones who are succeeding at this game are leaving the local level. So if I can't make that, I don't want to be left back with the chumps. That's a decision that I think some kids might be feeling. But then they also realize that they have a lot of options. Like, if you don't play youth sports, you can also do a lot of stuff in the home. You can play video games. And in many ways, I had a long conversation actually with Tom Ferry from Aspen about this that didn't make the article. In many ways, video games provide a lot of kids with many of the benefits that would conceivably come from sports, but sometimes don't. Playing video games is very social. But if you fail, you're not failing in front of your parents. You're often just, you know, failing in a virtual world where your parents can't see you. You're building sort of an understanding of a system of rules within that video game, and you're competing to win.
Well, Major League Baseball has spent some money here. The NBA has invested some money here. I mean, it really is incumbent on these larger organizations to sort of broaden their idea of what the mission is. That New York Times story that you referenced, Derek, has an anecdote in it about a guy named Brad Rothenberg, who's the son of Alan Rothenberg, who was the former head of the U.S. Soccer Federation. And he runs something called Alianza de Football to develop soccer among Latino kids. And his complaint is that U.S. soccer hasn't done enough to invest in Latino and African-American communities. And the response he gets in turn is that, well, you haven't developed enough elite players. So to me, the attitudinal shift has to be that we need to be supporting things like the Mamie Johnson Little League and soccer leagues in Latino and African-American communities to benefit all the kids, not just to find the next national team player. And that's a mentality that is, you know, it's confronted by economic realities and about the sort of goal-driven realities of some organizations.
I think that kids play sports often because they want to be like their heroes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember I loved playing Little League baseball. And when I played Little League baseball, my recreational activity was collecting baseball cards and trading baseball cards. And I was obsessed with Ken Griffey Jr. and Mark McGwire. I had Nolan Ryan shirts and posters all over my room. They were my heroes. And when I pitched and when I hit, I tried to imitate the batting stances of like Jeff Bagwell and Craig Biggio. And I tried to imitate the pitching styles of Roger Clemens. Like I was acting out my sort of super heroic fantasies. And when I think about, you know, who are today's kids' superheroes? Now, again, I don't know. I don't have kids. But I do know that kids are spending a lot of time, you know, not collecting baseball cards, but, you know, on YouTube and Instagram and Snapchat and, you know, following their idols there. And a lot of their superheroism, I think, has moved from baseball diamonds and maybe even soccer fields to digital worlds. And I don't believe that, you know, the rise of sort of digital entertainment and video games is the overall driving factor here in the decline of youth sports. If anything, I think it's secondary or tertiary. But I don't want to ignore the fact that that from my experience, I know that I enjoyed playing these games because it allowed me to act like my heroes. If today's kids' heroes aren't baseball players, then they're just going to have different dreams and different ideal recreational activities to act out those dreams.
Stefan, I'm curious what you think about what Derek mentioned in his piece about what's going on in Norway. I'm honestly sick of just hearing that people in Norway like do everything right and we do everything wrong. But let's talk about it anyway. Just this idea that they have a national lottery, they spend the proceeds of that lottery on youth sports, and there are all these rules about how you can't publish scores of games mm-hmm. for teams of kids that are under 13. Are these ideas here ones that we should try to emulate or that are kind of transferable given that we have all this infrastructure in place for how we do things already?
Yeah, the problem is scale, right? I mean, like applying something like the principles that Norway or the Netherlands, the principles that they use to develop soccer players and players in other sports, a sort of club-based system as opposed to a school-based system or as opposed to a town-based system, they're going to be really hard to transfer here.
Try it in America, Norway.
Yeah.
See how far you get.
Exactly. But in a lot of cases, we do that. We don't necessarily emphasize scores. Nobody's publishing scores in the rec soccer league in Washington, D.C. that I've been a part of. At the travel level, they publish standings and scores, but we're not doing that. We also don't have professional coaches to help kids develop at the rec level, and which is another factor that contributes to, I think, some attrition of playing and desire. But the European system, you know, they don't have a college-based system. They don't give scholarships to athletes. They don't compete in the same way that American universities compete. So I'm always wary of trying to graft these systems writ large. I mean, yeah, coaching skills at the higher level, ways to encourage kids to play as opposed to keep score. I mean, we've got some fundamental blockages in the United States about just the way we think about youth sports. It remains at all levels, rec or travel, elite, whatever. It remains a sort of competitive system. There is a score at the end. There is sort of less emphasis on the joy of play, and there's a lot of screaming, you know, 35-year-old dads on the sidelines.
I, I definitely don't think that the United States can ever simply import some Scandinavian model and be suddenly improved across the board. I think that a lot of these things are culturally specific. At the same time, I think that the juxtaposition with Norway here is instructive because my piece about the decline of youth sports isn't just about youth sports. It's about how America views success. That's why I gave the piece the somewhat controversial headline, American Meritocracy is Killing Youth Sports. I think in the US, we're very comfortable, whether it's because of the American dream or the sort of Protestant wealth gospel, of the idea of compounding success, that if you're really, really good at math, then you immediately get that kid into a really good math, into the accelerated math program as young as possible. And if they're really good at basketball, get them onto the accelerated program as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. Separate those who are seen as separately excellent as soon as you can to maximize success. And when I look at Norway and its considerably more collectivist approach to not just youth success, but youth participation in sports, what I see is that that approach hasn't obviously hurt them. And I think that if you took this youth sports story and you sort of expanded across the entire United States, you would see that the US clearly has this attitude of accelerated success across the board in many disciplines within school and in extracurricular activities. And it's just worth asking, is that necessarily the best way to produce, to sort of maximize successful outcomes for many people as a country?
Congratulations to Norway for doing well at the Winter Olympics. And thanks, Derek Thompson. The story is titled American Meritocracy is Killing Youth Sports. We'll link to it on our show page. Derek, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.